Thank you for joining us. To start off, I'll go through our land acknowledgement. So in the spirit of understanding and learning from what has come before, Perimeter respectfully acknowledges that it is located on the traditional territory of the Attawandaron, Anishinaabe, and Haudenosaunee peoples. In particular, we acknowledge that the Institute is located on the Haldimand Tract, land promised to the Six Nations of the Grand River and the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation, which includes 6 miles on each side of the Grand River. As settlers, we thank all generations of people who have taken care of this land for thousands of years. We commit collectively to making the promise and the challenge of truth and reconciliation real in our community. So I'm pleased to introduce our two speakers today. They are joining us for the day. They've been working with a number of groups within the organization to talk about accessibility in STEM and in the research environment. So we have Ms. Ainsley Latour and Dr. Mahadio Sukai. So just a bit of background on the two of them. So Ainsley Latour is the president and co-founder of IDEA STEM, an organization created to enhance the participation and inclusion for people with disabilities in STEM. She identifies as hard of hearing and neurodiverse. She also serves on the Government of Ontario's AODA, Post-Secondary Education Standards Development Committee. Ainsley's work on the experience of students with disabilities in Canada has been presented at national and international conferences on science and disability, including SciAccess 2019 and 2020, the Island 2020 Conference, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 2018, 2019, and 2021. She also maintains a practice as a licensed cytogenetic and molecular genetic technologist, MLT. She holds 2 undergraduate degrees, 2 graduate diplomas, and will graduate soon with a master's in marine environmental genetics from the Memorial University of Newfoundland. Dr. Mahadio Sukai is the world's first congenitally blind geneticist. Dr. Sukai is Vice President, Research and International Affairs and Chief Accessibility Officer for the CNIB. Having previously served as a researcher in cancer genomics at the University Health Network in Toronto, Dr. Sukai also holds an adjunct faculty appointment in the Department of Ophthalmology, School of Medicine, Queen's University in Kingston, as well as additional adjunct roles in the Faculty of Business and Information Technology at Ontario Tech University and in the Inclusive Design Program at OCAD University. In his role at CNIB, Dr. Sukai is responsible for organizational employee culture building strategy related to inclusion, accessibility, and employee wellness. Dr. Sukai is the principal investigator for Creating a Culture of Accessibility in the Sciences, a book based on his groundbreaking work on access to science within higher education, and serves as a principal investigator for national projects to examine accessibility and inclusion within science, education, and healthcare. Dr. Sukai co-founded IDEA STEM and INNOVA, the National Network of Researchers with Visual Impairments and Their Allies, a new professional society with the mission to improve accessibility and inclusion in the biomedical sciences for researchers with vision loss. Dr. Sukai is the external co-chair for the Canadian Institute of Health Research External Advisory Committee on the Accessibility and Systemic Ableism and the chair of the Employment Technical Committee for Accessibility Standards Canada. So a lot of really groundbreaking work and involved in many different environments. The two of them we're very fortunate to have come and talk to us today. I want to just point out the book that was mentioned earlier. We actually have it available in our library for anyone that's interested in having a read. It's quite interesting because it goes from a number of different perspectives, so you can get really a well-rounded view on accessibility in STEM. With that, I'll pass it over to our speakers.
Okay. Thank you very much, Angela, and thank you to all of you for coming. It is such a pleasure to be here, and having received such a warm welcome, it's just a real pleasure to be here and interacting with all kinds of different people today. I'm hoping that over the course of the next hour, we'll offer you something that can be food for thought, and we're definitely happy to continue the conversation after you've had time to let it sit in your minds and process. So we are available through email if people do want to follow up on anything that we have to say. We are a small group today too, so if you have a question, you can hold it to the end, but you don't have to. If you want to just ask it, you just jump in. Mahadio lives with vision loss, so he might not see a raised hand. I live with hearing loss. I may not hear any of you really well, but someone will repeat it for me if I need that. So please just jump in at any time if you do want to make a comment or ask a question. So normally I would do a lot of audio description of our slides, but we have 75 slides and quite a lot of information to share with you. We may not get through it all, but I'm going to give an example of how I would audio describe this for someone with a print-based disability, and then you won't hear a lot of that through the rest of the presentation. So to begin with, our title slide's on a plum purple background with bold white text. The IdeaSTEM logo is at the bottom center. It consists of the text, Idea-STEM, with three hexagons, which are adjacent to each other but not touching, around the M in STEM. So as Angela mentioned, this is me. I'm not going to do too much with this slide, except that inevitably was an older biography, and I do have a master's in evolutionary genetics, and these are all the things that I do. Similar, Mahadio, I don't know if you want to...
I actually don't want to say too much about this slide either, but good afternoon, everybody. I'm Mahadio, pronouns are he and him. And you heard my bio, so I'm not going to dwell on this, only to say that both Ainsley and I have been doing this work for, I think, what amounts to be a very long time. And so, you know, the combined experience that we have in the space of accessibility and inclusion in STEM generally and the scientific research enterprise specifically is 2.5 decades or so. So we're gonna take you on a journey today, and hopefully it'll be a fun, entertaining conversation. If you have questions during, we'll throw one of these catch boxes at you, which ought to be kind of fun.
Okay, so let's just spend a little bit reviewing some of the terms and metrics that we talk about when we're talking about inclusion, equity, diversity, and accessibility work. The first one is diversity, and what you might not know about these terms is you can actually measure every single one of them, and you should be measuring every single one of them applied to different areas of your organization and your work to do inclusion work properly. It is, in fact, work that should be done by collecting data, by analyzing it, making small changes, and then analyzing and testing again to see if you're making a difference. So diversity is probably the simplest thing to measure out of all of the metrics we're going to talk about. It is a counting term, and so we're just counting levels of diversity. But the thing about diversity is that it's only relative to something else. So maybe you're comparing it to, you know, a census population of Canadians, or you're looking at, you know, all the people involved in different STEM fields, or you're looking at the numbers of people from different demographics that are available to you, and you're comparing the diversity within your organization to that. So diversity is always subjective, and it's comparable to the diversity within some other population. And so when you look at this and you decide to start counting, you do have to define really specifically what you're comparing it to and what you're counting. Many people have probably heard the term equity. The thing about this is that it is different than equality. Equality is things being equal, and when we offer people the same thing, we inevitably do not meet their needs. This is true for people with disabilities, but it's also true for a number of other people who may have experiences of being or identifying as part of some other equity group. And equity as well can be measured, usually in policies or in processes. We can look at it and say, you know, who is this not equitable for, and how can we make it equitable? Inclusion, of course, is a little bit different than equity in that we're talking about people's feelings and experiences of belonging, people's ability to show up as themselves in their workplace in this case, and not feel like they have to hide, you know, their gender identity or their gender expression, for example, which is quite a lot of work, or people with disabilities can come to work and don't have to hide what their disability is or a need, or perform a task in their job that's really hard for them without an accommodation because they're afraid to ask for one. And we can measure inclusion oftentimes by asking questions that require qualitative answers to how much belonging people feel in the workplace. We can also indirectly measure this in the workplace by doing an attitude survey, and where the questions on that survey are not sort of obvious as to what the most politically correct response would be. And then, of course, we have accessibility. So most people are familiar with this term, but there's a few things about this term that are important to know. When we talk about accessibility, we don't mean availability. And accessibility can be for anyone, whether they have a disability or not. And many of us will acquire some sort of disability over our time period as professionals in a workplace setting, whether that is temporary or perhaps long-term or episodic. We'll talk about that a little bit more. Accessibility is an important piece. And when we measure accessibility, it's not just something accessible, but it, who is this policy or practice accessible to, and who is it not accessible to? And often when we talk about accessibility, we need to be very specific because, of course, people with disabilities are a very big heterogeneous group, and there are a lot of different needs in that group. And similarly with other equity-deserving groups. Now, when we talk about land acknowledgments, one of the purposes and the value of doing them is that you're offering a real organic reflection about how you relate to the land that you are on and have a privilege to be on, and how your relationship is not just to the land, but the people on it. And the one that I'm going to offer here is that the process of identifying as a person with a disability, asking for accommodations in the workplace to do your job is very highly colonialized. A lot of indigenous groups do not actually talk about disability and label it in the way that we're very familiar with. And ongoing colonialism work or decolonizing this particular practice of disability inclusion is a thing, but it's not talked about very often. So again, rethinking ability, you could summarize it in this way as well. Disability is differences in the way we take in and process information, and differences in how we communicate, differences in how we interact with the information that we're taking in. And this is not to minimize it, but often when we think about disability, we think about a lack of or not being able to do something. And we're just gonna invite you to think about disability or ability in a little bit of a different way here. Ism blindness. So what we mean by ism blindness, again, is in the 1970s, it was very politically acceptable to say, like, I don't see your color, or I don't see your disability. I don't care that you have a disability. You can do the same thing that everyone else can do. Well, no, that's not true. People's lived experiences really do matter, and we need to be talking about them, and we need to be acknowledging our differences. And so now it is actually okay to ask people, or talk about them as if they are different, or as if they are a black person, or a person of color, or indigenous person. And with disability, you know, ask people what language you want them to use when you talk about it. So even though, you know, in the 1970s, we were sort of attempting not to be biased by a person's lived experience, inevitably we are if we're pretending that it doesn't matter, because it really, really does. So now we go to ism awareness, and that's a really helpful thing because we do recognize that people come to the workplace with different experiences. Some of them probably experienced the experience of trauma from all the subtle discriminations they may have experienced because of their lived experience. And pointing out that they are different and pointing out some of those biases when they do occur, even though it's a really uncomfortable conversation, if it's done in the correct way, can really work to eliminate biases from the workplace and work towards a more inclusive workplace culture. So, Mahadiu.
I always have to remember to turn the microphone on. So let's talk a little bit about the scientific research ecosystem and disability as we go through this. So the scientific research ecosystem is represented by a series of offset concentric circles on the slide, and it starts with the scientist, the person actually doing the work, includes their colleagues, their supervisors, their collaborators, includes the people who give them money, includes the knowledge translation to peers and to the community at large, and includes the public. So how we think about disability and how we think about persons with disabilities in the context of science, we tend to be very transactional about it. We tend to be very much of the, okay, so how do we How do we work with you to provide workplace adjustments or accessibility supports in the context of your scientific research, in the context of your training? But in reality, it's not that. It's that this person who's doing the science, who's doing the research, who's being trained, is inside this really large ecosystem where they're interacting with a lot of people. And all of those interactions need to be taken into account when we are talking about accessibility and disability in the sciences. And that's a conversation that hasn't typically happened. And again, because of that transactional nature of the conversation, I will tell you at this point that we don't use the word accommodation. I have a personal animus against the word accommodation. We will use workplace adjustment. We will use accessibility support. You'll find the word accommodation a couple of times on these slides as we go through because it's the expected word, but we'll always try to deconstruct it when it shows up. Let's talk a little bit about something that comes from genetics, which is our field. I started in astrophysics, and I said to the session this morning, I got out of astrophysics not because I hate astrophysics, I don't. I've loved astrophysics since I was four, but rather because I had the world's worst computer science instructor in first year. And I made a very big mistake, and that is I actually let a bad instructor dictate my career choices, right? Which is not something any student should actually ever have to do. Part of the reason I did that was accessibility, and part of the reason I did that was because he was just horribly bad, right? And he wasn't able to teach to my strengths, and I actually let him then make a choice about what I wanted to do. So what's here comes from genetics, and it's the notion of how we tend to interact with our environment and what's intrinsic and what's intrinsic about what we do and how we do it. And so we've got intrinsic factors that are person-centered, we've got extrinsic factors that are systemic in nature, and they act in a bit of a seesaw fashion to define how we work and who we are. In the sciences, we can talk about genetics and lifestyle in the context of cancer risk, in the context of cardiovascular disease risk, in the context of dementia risk. We can talk about nature and nurture in the context of psychology. But where that model doesn't get applied, and it actually should get applied, is in the context of persons with disabilities, particularly in the context of persons with disabilities in STEM. And so person plus training environment gives us success in education. Person plus colleagues gives us success in the workplace. Person plus policy framework gives us success in navigating the spaces around us. And person plus social capital gives us success in our careers. And so we don't think like that in the context of disability at all, because everything is all about the person. It's not about the environment that surrounds the person. So let's deconstruct that. Let's talk a little bit about why the way we think about disability is wrong. And as a society and in the context of everything that goes on in STEM and research and training. So first of all, somebody can live with a disability from birth. That's congenital. Somebody can live with a disability from early childhood. Somebody can live with a disability from early adulthood, so when one is in post-secondary education. Somebody can live with a disability from working age, early working age, later working age, and somebody can live with a disability after they retire and over the age of 65. Conceptually, we don't think there's a difference between any of those, and by we, I don't mean the two of us standing up here. We absolutely think there's a difference between those. But I mean the global we in society. Disability is disability. It's treated as a monolithic construct, but it really isn't, because the quality of life for somebody who is congenitally disabled, or the quality of life for somebody who acquires a lived experience with a disability from a young age, is fundamentally different than the quality of life of somebody who acquires a lived experience at the age of 50, or who acquires a lived experience at the age of 70. Disability context also needs to be taken into consideration. We tend to think about disability as a permanent thing, and so there's a series of linked circles on the slide, and so we think about disability as if it were permanent, as if it were static, as if it were a trait, right? As if it were a trait, as if it were something that you live with forevermore, and that's the way it is. But it's not necessarily that's true. Someone can actually live with a temporary disability. Someone can live with an episodic disability. One that shows up in spring or fall or winter more than any other time, or a lived experience that manifests more at 9 o'clock in the morning than at 9 o'clock at night, right? Someone can live with a progressive disability, right? One that changes and evolves over time. One can live with a situational disability depending on the context that one is in. We also talk a lot academically and a lot in society about apparent and non-apparent disabilities. The third week of October, 2 weeks ago, was Hidden Disabilities Week or Invisible Disabilities Week in Canada. The terms hidden and invisible are loaded terms and somewhat problematic. So non-apparent disabilities. We categorize as apparent disabilities physical and sensory disabilities, and we categorize as non-apparent disabilities everything else. But that's wrong. Here's why. We don't take into account the functional impact that one lives with in considering their lived experience with a disability, so severity, and we don't take into account the use of assistive technology, assistive aids, or other devices. So assistive technology, broadly speaking, is any device, anything whatsoever, that facilitates a person with a disability performing daily tasks. And so I said it's any device. That means it's not just a specialized device. So you can think of a walker, you can think of a wheelchair, you can think of a guide dog, you can think of a white cane, you can think of a hearing aid or a cochlear implant. Those are all specialized devices. But you think of a smartphone, and you wouldn't put it in the category of assistive device usually, because people don't think that a smartphone falls in that category, because everybody uses a smartphone. But that's true. Everybody uses a smartphone, but a smartphone has a lot of accessibility features that make it easier for somebody like myself, for example, to navigate downtown Waterloo, right? I don't need a talking GPS. I can follow the little blue dot on my phone, right? And so if I walk around the downtown area following the little blue dot on my phone, I look no different than any other person who's walking the downtown area, you know, staring at their phone. Particularly in downtown Toronto, this is absolutely a thing. Perhaps less so out here. Definitely in Kingston, much less so. Right? And so by this definition, as I said, a smartphone and its associated apps are assistive technology. Everyone uses a smartphone, though. And so you can't now just rely on the use of assistive technology because you're no longer sure what assistive technology is. And the other thing about assistive technology is it's used when it's needed, but it's not necessarily something that's used all the time. My white cane is upstairs in the office. I don't have it with me. But I do have sighted guides handy, and Ainsley and Angela, and so if I need assistance to move around in this stage, and notice I'm keeping myself confined to a very specific area, which I walked before, and I understand what it is, and I know I'm not going to fall through the floor, right? So if you did not know I had a visual impairment because I'm not using a piece of assistive technology, you wouldn't, right? So an apparent disability then is apparent when someone who is using an assistive device is using it in a manner that helps them carry out some daily tasks in a way that becomes obvious to an observer, right? So then, if that's true, we have to think about disability as something very different than what we think about disability as usually. And we need to think about the fact that our lived experiences as persons with disabilities are impacted by our age of onset, they're impacted by the context of our disability, the severity of our lived experience, our use of assistive aids and devices, and the environment that we are in. So yes, that means that everyone's going to have a different experience, but it also means that we cannot take a monolithic approach to the conversation of disability. Let's park that for a moment. Let's talk about disclosure and accommodation. I've used the dirty word. I've said it. I'm not going to say it anymore, right? So the conversation here is around, as trainees, how do we, in the context of our educational environments, identify that we have a workplace need or a trainee or a training program need for accessibility supports. As employees of an entity like a Perimeter Institute, how do we identify that we have a workplace adjustment need or a workplace accessibility need? We do this by self-identifying as a person with a disability. And so this process is called disclosure. It can also be called self-identification, right? This is synonymous with saying, Mahadio needs large print. So if I say, I have low vision to Angela or Shannon, right, then I have effectively said, I have low vision, I need large print. If I just said I need large print, then the conversation is gonna be, well, why do you need large print? So what ends up happening is the I have low vision tends to come first because that's the expectation. It is required for accommodation supports or accessibility supports in education and employment settings. It's considered a component of self-advocacy of persons with disabilities. I read something recently that persons with disabilities are actually the only group of human beings for whom the world doesn't necessarily work, but we're the ones expected to address that, not anyone else expected to address it with us. So this process of accommodation, this process of receiving accessibility supports requires disclosure because it's a reactive process. It's ask and respond. So you need to ask for help. And there's a human rights requirement behind that. And the human rights requirement is the disclosure of need of accessibility support. What that is assumed to mean, it's actually not specified that it means this, but it's assumed to mean this in practice, that you require medical or similar documentation of diagnosis or functional impact in order to start the process. But then who mediates between that diagnostic documentation and the functional impacts piece? So how do you go from Dr. Sukai has congenital cataracts with deprivation amblyopia, nystagmus, and a neurological vision loss to Dr. Sukai needs large print, right? Because there is nobody in this room, aside from me, who's actually qualified to tell you that. And I'm the one asking for the help, right? So then we've got a major problem because we're asking people for documentation that doesn't actually say what they need, and then we're expecting to translate that somehow, but nobody knows how. So again, functional route that a worker or a job applicant takes into the workplace adjustment or workplace accessibility support process, that's what disclosure is. It is necessary and sufficient to trigger the process. It is essential. You cannot go through the process without the disclosure, but that disclosure is synonymous with a declaration, and that is, I need help. So what's wrong with all of this? The technical answer is nothing. The practical answer is a whole lot. And the reason that there's a whole lot wrong with it is there's some hidden assumptions in behind that nobody really knows how to unpack, which I'm going to take you through very briefly. First of all, disclosure equals I ask for help, right? The hidden philosophy in our society in North America is if you need help, it's okay to ask for it. In practice, though, we live in a very DIY culture. And so if you're asking for help, the first question that's going to pop up is, well, I'm sorry, why do you want the help? You know? Disclosure is also, I have to tell you about my disability. But that's not the legal requirement. The legal requirement is I tell you about a functional need that I have. I need large print, right? But in practice, over the past 70 or 80 years, we don't accept I need large print. The first thing that happens is, well, prove to me that you need large print. There we go, I got the words out. So the question that gets asked is, where's your diagnosis information? With the practice of disclosure, what we also do is we also create this thing called a person-centered process. So we put the person with a disability in charge of the conversation, except that's actually not what happens. What actually happens is the person with the disability ends up being the one that everyone asks why and asks for that legitimization. And so it's less being in charge of the conversation and more being in a position where you're getting asked a whole pile of invasive questions, which can make you very uncomfortable. And then the other thing is disclosure is about making the need obvious. And in giving this part of this presentation to human resources professionals, I have heard ad nauseum and ad infinitum. Yeah, but if we don't ask, how will we know what somebody needs? Okay, fair, because you never want to assume that the person with the disability is the one who knows themselves the best. So you never want to assume what somebody else might require in order to do their work, so you always want to ask about it. The problem is that, okay, you're going to ask me, so Angela's going to ask me, I'm sorry, I'm picking on you, Angela, but Angela's going to ask me, you know, well, what do you need to do your job? I'm going to tell Angela, I need large print. Angela's going to say, what kind of large print? And I'm going to say, Verdana size 16 font. And Angela's going to go back and go through the occupational health and safety mechanisms here at the Perimeter Institute and come back to me and say, no, I can give you Calibri 10. I'm sorry, that's not large print. That's crap, right? But then the employer has the right to say, well, I can't do that because it's going to inconvenience me. Right? Pressing the wrong button. Okay. The other thing that goes on in the context of accommodation in the workplace is it's very much a let's talk about your job. So all of you, many of you are theoretical physicists. Your jobs are defined around theoretical physics and astrophysics and cosmology. And so when you think about your accessibility supports, often what you will think about is, well, how do I do that job? But the problem is, that job doesn't exist in a vacuum. That job exists in a space where you're interacting with an ecosystem of people that we talked about before, your manager, your teammates, your peers, your collaborators, your stakeholders, and your customers or clients. And you're using a pile of technology. You're using a pile of business systems. You're using internal business systems, third-party digital tools. You name the coding platform of choice, you're using it. You name the software for analysis of choice, you're using it. You're using virtual meeting platforms. You're using online learning management systems. You're using training material. You're using the built environment, including furniture and lighting, and you're using IT. And so your workplace supports do not take any of that into consideration. So do you really expect them to work? Ainsley?
Okay. That's 2:30.
Yep, I know.
Oops. Okay, the training pipeline. So many of you are familiar with this. We showed this slide, I think, this morning briefly as well. We start off in K-12 education, we move on to college, undergraduate education. From there, we might go into professional studies or graduate education or diploma programs, any of that kind of stuff. We might then do a residency, a fellowship, or a postdoc, and then some of us end up in employment. And that is the way that it is supposed to be to work. But for people with equity-deserving backgrounds, particularly Indigenous peoples and peoples with disabilities, and people who identify with both of those two groups, it actually looks more like a funnel because there are huge barriers at every single stage. And so if you put in a lot of people with disabilities at the very beginning of that pipeline, they all go to kindergarten, whatever, at each stage of the process, you're going to lose the masses. And so one of the things we can do to increase the numbers of people with disabilities is obviously to flood the pipeline, but you're still going to have huge numbers of people leaving at every stage, during every stage, and only a few going over into the next stage of the process. The other thing we can do is start to remove the barriers. So again, 2 points of entry. Scenario one is the lived experience with disability. So that is people who have early onset or they're born with their disability and they acquire it and they go through the process with this disability. And then as Mahadio alluded earlier, you could have a disability and acquire it later in life, but have gone through some stages of that pipeline or all the stages in that pipeline all the way to employment without having your disability. And my question is, what do you think is more difficult? The response is living with that disability and trying to get through the pipeline with it rather than acquiring it later. Now, both are very difficult situations for different reasons, but generally to achieve employment and to launch your career, it is much easier to acquire a disability in the workplace than it is to go through school and postdoctoral training and become a theoretical physicist with a disability the entire time. So as we said, the funnel looks a little bit more like a funnel for members of equity-deserving groups, particularly people with disabilities. In the life sciences sector in Canada and also in Ontario, there's beginning to be a little bit of data. It's not great data, but it's the only data we have to indicate that persons with disabilities, in fact, do not work very much in the life sciences. And if they do, they're not in scientific positions, and they're definitely not in positions where they have a platform to make decisions and influence the leadership of and change how things are done in that profession. We don't have, to my knowledge, any data about the numbers of people from equity-deserving groups who practice theoretical physics. However, at the Canadian Science Policy Conference in a couple of weeks, we're going to start making noise about collecting that data for all the different disciplines and different types of disabilities and really getting a good look at what's going on. Because we know that from the Tri-Council Agencies of Canada, NSERC as an example, very few scientists with disabilities or who are Indigenous apply for funding. People of color are generally in the STEM fields in Canada, however, they don't generally make it to leadership positions, and similar with women. So obviously, there's a bunch of barriers that we can talk about, and we will talk about some of them as we go forward. Transitional barriers, so barriers to employment, barriers to entry into college or university, barriers into entry into graduate school, and lack of professional models who identify with the disability. That one is huge. There are actually a number of scientists throughout history who have had disabilities, but you know, we talk about their science, we might talk about where they lived or whatever, but we don't talk about the fact that they might have had a lived experience with a disability. Most people know about Stephen Hawking. He, of course, is a very important name here. But who else? There are many other physicists who had disabilities. Do you know? Like, how come you don't know? So all of those are huge barriers that way. It's very difficult to be a student with a disability in STEM or even an employee because there's not many people who do things the way you do things or who are like you. And experiencing that lonely place makes it very difficult to keep up a career like that, especially if you're the only one in your family or in your community that has that disability as well. We also have environmental barriers, so gatekeeping. We'll talk about that one in a second. Attitudes, of course, are one of the worst. Designing the learning spaces, labs aren't accessible, lab equipment's not accessible, and those, of course, are really important. Maybe not now in theoretical physics, but definitely in the training pipeline. And we require scientists to be able to perform labs in order to practice as scientists. But you know, not all scientists ever perform lab work. Why? Why is this a requirement? It's stupid. So all kinds of barriers there. And here, again, this is some examples of attitudes. So the gatekeeping occurs either by disability service professionals, so who provide accessibility supports to people, or people who are disciplined, have expertise in a particular discipline, not disability, but in the discipline of study, and they say, you know, you can't have this accommodation in the workplace or in the discipline, therefore you can't have it in your training, for example. And disability service providers don't know the discipline, but they say, oh, you can't possibly do that, you know, with a disability. And there's lots of issues with that. And then, you know, they might ask students, why are we here? And often, especially for students with disabilities who are in specialized schools, they're discouraged from doing any science at all. They're told, you know, you can't do this. Why would you want to do this? You don't need to do this. You need to learn something else instead. And those attitudes need to stop. And so they start quite early. And by the time students get to college and university and postdoctoral training and graduate school and into the workplace, their own internalized ableist attitudes are unconscious to them, but quite prominent. And of course, the students then pick up these attitudes based on the experiences they're exposed to of professionals, where, you know, they don't have to do this. Why should I learn it? I can't do this. Why am I here? And the worst one is the trailblazing one, where they think they're the first student with a disability in their particular discipline, when that might not be the reality, but because the students with disabilities are so rare in different disciplines, they all think that they're the first. So again, the gatekeeper function when comes about when the attitude based on the scientist or the student accessibility support person believes that the person is incapable or not fit to carry out the work in that particular discipline. And again, it can arise this way as well. I'm just gonna go through these, past these, because there's so much more we wanna give you today. So the trainee supervisor dynamic. I wrote a paper when I was in graduate school, actually, with Dr. Sukai. He was doing a night job where he was volunteering and leading this research study on the experiences of graduate students with disabilities across Canada. And if you are interested in this paper, it is still published on the website of the National Educational Association of Disabled Students. So these are examples of some of the barriers that can impact that trainee-supervisor relationship where the student has a disability. So having a disability is a lot of work. It is a lot of work to run around, make a whole bunch of disclosures, to finally maybe arrange an accommodation because there's so many people around you in the ecosystem that all of that work, that advocacy, takes quite a lot of effort and energy. And if you're a grad student life, probably your time is pretty limited because of all the competition and the need to get through very quickly. There's lots of stigma, so trying to put the energy to cope with all those negative attitudes takes quite a lot too. The isolation, imposter syndrome, all of those things. Diversity identity or disability identity, all of those intersections really matter. We don't have time to get into them today, but they do have an impact. And all of that really impacts mental health and wellness. For the supervisor, there's power dynamic. If you're a student with a disability and you're asking your supervisor for, you know, accessibility supports, that can be pretty intimidating. And that supervisor has the advantage of having sort of power over often that student, and they can just say no and dismiss it right there and it goes nowhere else. A supervisor often, though, having a lot of knowledge about, you know, how to coach or mentor and how to study in their field, does not necessarily have the expertise to respond appropriately to a student who has a disability or the skills to socialize that student into the academic discipline. We know that a student, once they become a scientist, when they're a graduate student, need to tap into social capital. They need to be socialized into their discipline as much as they need to learn how to work and do the things in their discipline. And supervised students with disabilities are not prepared to help that student be socialized into the academy. The willingness to engage in conversations around disability, again, different supervisors, different amounts of willingness, and that impacts the student-supervisor relationship, and then boundary issues, of course, as well. But we can talk about those probably another day when we have time. So looking through the literature, and it's a little bit old, this work now, but the literature generally characterizes a high-quality relationship for a student, any student, with their supervisor as a mutual understanding of expectations around the roles and responsibilities of the student and the supervisor. And there can be a lack of clarity around the expectations that relate to accommodations, accessibility supports, socialization around disabilities, providing other people with the skills to interact with that student, all of those things. So disability can really impact some of those communication and some of those expectations. So high levels of interaction. So again, if a student is not comfortable or they make a disclosing comment to their supervisor doesn't respond in a way that invites conversation, they're gonna see their supervisor less, and that can be a problem. So if you want a high level relationship with your supervisor, we know from the literature, those supervisor-student relationships that are very high quality and very effective, there's a lot of communication. The mentor is also very purposely helping that student progress in a timely manner. And we know that the relationship is flexible, it's mutually respectful, and both have very strong communication skills. On the other hand, you can have low quality relationships with between supervisors and students. So some of the opposite then are true. Lack of clarity for boundaries and expectations around not just work productivity, but also around disability and accessibility accommodations. Students might not disclose to a faculty member that they have a disability, and that can lead to a low quality relationship because it impacts trust in the student supervisor relationship, which is really important for a high quality relationship. And then the fear of stigma, again, if a student is living, you know, in fear of and not disclosing a need, they're gonna have a low quality relationship with their supervisor. Maybe they don't get their accommodations they wanted or they needed for their disability because they were afraid of being stigmatized, and now their productivity is being impacted, and all of a sudden the relationship with their supervisor has gone from an okay relationship to something that's low quality because you know, they're not progressing and their supervisor doesn't understand why, and there's no communication. And then, of course, attitudinal barriers on the part of the supervisor can impact that relationship as well. And where there are a lot of attitudinal barriers that can translate to a low quality relationship for persons with disabilities or students with disabilities and trainees with their supervisor. So these are just some examples of attitudinal barriers that, again, impact the quality of that relationship. And we know that the students who have high quality relationships do finish their degrees more often. They get those papers published. That's better, good for the supervisor, it's good for the student, and of course it's good for the school. And so, Mahario?
Okay. So I'm gonna bring this conversation home in the next 10 minutes or so. One of the things that we saw from the data of the study that Ainsley just talked about, and she led that part of the overall project, when we actually asked graduate students their perspectives, we were seeing a 6-to-1 ratio of neutral to positive relationship to negative relationship. The problem is nobody talks about the 6 relationships between their students and their supervisors that are neutral to positive. Everybody focuses on the one relationship that's in the tank, and of the one relationship out of 7 that's in the tank, everyone's focusing on the 1 in 10 that's so catastrophically in the tank that it's causing a serious problem. So there's also a little bit of a myth around how many students with disabilities actually run into barriers, because many students will be able to navigate the space not easily, but we'll be able to navigate the space. Now, the interesting thing is that navigation of the space takes effort. So let's talk about mental health impacts. That navigation of the space takes cognitive load. And there's two concepts. You've already heard imposter syndrome. You've already heard trailblazing for the mental health working group here. Let's add cognitive load or access work and weathering to the conversation. Cognitive load is the additional effect that goes, additional effort that goes into being a person with a disability in the sciences, right? So these are things that we need to think about as scientists with disabilities that our non-disabled peers don't have to think about, and they can manifest as extra finances, extra time, extra effort, expenditure of social capital. If you want an example, we can talk about conference travel over the social half an hour. Both Ainsley and I identify as accessibility and inclusion professionals, but we're scientists first. We had to become accessibility and inclusion professionals secondarily in order to be scientists, right? And so my job isn't an accessibility professional or an accessibility expert. My job is a scientist. That is how I view myself. That is my professional identity. Thank you very much, right? And it's an important thing to recognize because I've actually had a bunch of folks who do research within the space come to me and say, hey, you're a person with a disability. You must know what you're talking about because you have a PhD. And I've written back rather sharply, are you aware I've done this work for 20 years? And by the way, I'm a legitimate scientist. I breathe, I eat, I function just like any other scientist does. The other concept is weathering. So cognitive load is the effort that goes into being a scientist as a person with a disability. Weathering is the stress and negative impact on mental well-being that comes from having to do that and that comes from experiencing ableism and attitudinal barriers along the way. And so that leads to depletion of emotional reserves and burnout. So in an ideal world, particularly for trainees, what we hope happens is if somebody discloses a functional need, then there's a development of accessibility solutions and there's a provision of said accessibility solutions. Would that it were so easy. Faculty members can say, well, you're the first I ever heard of, and have resistance to participation in the program. That could lead to the gatekeeper function and various degrees of mental health stress. Faculty could say, are you really the first that I've ever heard of? And you can actually go off and think about, well, let me make sure. So I heard this in third year. You're the first geneticist who's blind. And I did my homework because I'm a scientist and I like to do homework. And I went and I actually empirically determined actually in 1996 when I was in third year, yes, I was the first congenitally blind geneticist that anyone had ever heard of. So then you were actually a trailblazer, a real trailblazer, as opposed to one who might be the first in their school or the first in their department, right? And that leads to imposter syndrome and mental health issues. The faculty might say, well, accommodations won't work because. And then we can get into a conversation about, well, what are the legitimate essential requirements of your discipline? That can also lead to mental health issues. The disability service provider can say, well, I don't know what to do here, and say, And then you're in the space of actually trying to figure it out and solve that set of barriers for yourself, which leads to mental health issues. All of this could also tie to stigma from peers and from faculty and your perceptions, well, do I really belong? Which gets us back to the imposter syndrome conversation. The faculty members, not necessarily in theoretical physics, but in a lot of clinical sciences, the faculty members can say, well, you know what? I treat persons with disabilities. Let me treat you as the student or the postdoc. And then you don't really need to have this, you don't really need to do this other thing, and so then the boundary between mentorship and being a clinician gets blurred, and that causes mental health issues. That's a lot of mental health issues. Your mental health working group has a lot of work to do. So let's talk about how we break these ossified traditions. All of what we've just talked to you comes from a few things. It comes from the industrialization of science post-World War II. It comes from North America's do-it-yourself culture. It comes from manufacturing. We had a great conversation earlier today about how all of today's HR standard policies come from manufacturing. So manufacturing is up here. And it comes from, as Ainsley commented on earlier, colonialism and ableism within society. And these things give rise to the environment that we as scientists with disabilities are trying to navigate in. So some equations for you, because I love math and I used to be in astrophysics, and I can't stop myself. I have to have equations. So the way we think about diversity in scientific teams is diversity in thought plus diversity in skill equals innovation. Diversity in thought equals diversity in knowledge plus diversity in experiences. So conceivably, that's the timer telling me it's 2:50. So conceivably, we've thought about this mostly in terms of skill sets and knowledge. But diversity in thought isn't just that. Diversity in thought is knowledge, training, background, and intersectional identity, right? And so if you take that part of the equation and put it back in the original equation, then innovation is equal to diversity in knowledge, training, background, intersectional identity, and skill, right? And so now, when we think about building diverse scientific teams, we have to think about bringing everybody's lived experiences to the table as opposed to, as Ainsley said before, not, right? So how do we do that, right? That gets us this conversation about inclusion in research. When we talk about inclusion in research, we have to talk about the entirety of the research lifecycle, which starts with, let's put the team together to ask the question, all the way through asking the question and collecting the data and analyzing the data and interpreting the data and telling the world about it so that you can re-ask the question, right? So when we think about inclusion in research, we do have to recognize that researchers are human beings. Human beings are doing research, not robots. I mean, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, absolutely state-of-the-art robots from the day, but humans are the ones controlling them, right? And so you ask the question of who's on the team. Ainsley talked about ism blindness and ism awareness before. This is where that comes in handy, right? And we recognize also something that comes sort of from the neurodivergent space, which is the style of thought is the last bastion of diversity. So diversity in thought is important to our conversations. We need to talk also about inclusion of research, our recruitment approaches if we're doing human-centered research, less applicable here, our data collection methods or data analysis approaches, right? The tools that we use to do data analysis, the equipment that we're using in our work, theoretical or experimental. We need to talk about how we talk about our research in the context of publication and social media and mainstream media. And we really need to come back to how we frame our research questions, right? If we don't ask from the principle of accessibility and inclusion, we're never going to know the answer, where that's relevant in the context of human actions, right? And in doing so, there's always a balance between privacy and confidentiality and the effective understanding of confounders and effects, right? And that becomes a research ethics conversation, which, again, less applicable perhaps in the setting of theoretical physics, but absolutely applicable in the context of anything to do with human beings and research ethics boards. So when we think about the pillars of inclusion that go toward addressing the many problems that we've talked about, we need to talk about inclusive perspectives, we need to talk about inclusive teams, we need to talk about how our documentation is accessible, we need to talk about research and methodology design and how to make them inclusive, we need to talk about accessible data collection methods, accessible tools, and inclusive communication. Angela already talked of the book, but our contact information is also on the slide. We've got time for a few questions, and we have a half an hour social afterward where you can pepper us with lots of questions while we have coffee. Okay. Are you actually going to throw one of these things?
Just wait. Yeah, just watch. Oh, okay, maybe not that far. I'll walk it up partway.
Did I just hear, oh?
Okay. My knowledge about this is a few years old, but last time I checked, we had a student who I thought really deserved like a fellowship or postdoctoral fellowship, and then I was looking at all of these science funding agencies, and I couldn't find a single fellowship for a person with disability who really deserved a chance. I don't know if, I mean, there was a lot of funding for doing research in like some of these topics, but not actually fund the person who has a disability. I'm wondering if things have changed.
No.
No.
A simple answer, they have not changed. CIHR is thinking about changing it. Mm-hmm. NSERC's copied CIHR's plan. So NSERC may or may not think about changing it. but I mean, the short answer is No, and it is a legitimate barrier within the space. Both a lack of funding for accessibility support as dedicated money and a lack of funding for trainees with disabilities.
Thank you.
We have both consulted with CAHR and NSERC in various capacities. And I know that there's discussion at NSERC about having a program to fund people with disabilities specifically by itself, so that they compete sort of against themselves in that group, but not so much against people who have had many more privileges to develop their skills and resumes and scientific background than they have. Such a program right now does exist for Indigenous students. It's never existed in Canada for students with disabilities, but the United States has significantly more funding in science for scientists with disabilities. Now that has dropped significantly as a result of the pandemic, but they are doing better than us generally with recognizing that students with disabilities and researchers with disabilities do not at all have a level playing field from at any point in their career. And we're hoping Canada will get on board with it, but right now there isn't a lot.
So one of the other things that Ainsley's just implied that I'm gonna outright state is, and it should be, I think, relatively clear from the subtext of our presentation, accessible science is good science. It's not add-on science, it's good science, but it also fundamentally calls into question the age-old assumptions, for example, around authorship, around productivity, around who does the work, around what the essential requirements of individual disciplines are, that science is actually all about. And unless we are willing to have those conversations openly, and we're willing to have those conversations without preconception, then some of the things that are very systemic issues, like funding for trainees, it will be very difficult to move those needles.
Any other questions?
Come on, throw it at somebody. Yeah. Throw it at somebody.
You want to see that?
So as an institution, how do we get good at the giving, when someone's asking for that support, how do we get good at knowing what to offer them? Or, you know, we don't want to put it on them to tell us exactly what they need, but how do we get good at that? It seems like a very difficult thing.
So I think it has to be a conversation. It can be difficult to navigate all the privacy and confidentiality pieces that are mandated by law, but I gotta say, whoever wrote the accommodation process and all the legal requirements that go along with it never had to use the system. The system is terrible, it's broken, and it doesn't work. And eventually, maybe, you know, the government will catch up with those standards. Mahadio chaired the technical committee part of the under the Accessible Canada Act that was responsible for developing standards for employment under that would apply eventually to federally regulated spaces. Right now, they are out for public consultation, I think, for another week or two.
Week and a half.
So please take a look at that. I can offer a hint. But I think there's a few different ways to target that question. It's a really excellent one. The Federal Public Service uses something called an accessibility passport. Probably not the greatest, but it does help take some burden off the person with the disability to do other advocacy work. They essentially get documentation and get the public service to sign off on this thing that said they need the following accommodations, and then they take that with them wherever they go in the federal public service, and they don't have to go through the same song and dance around accommodations during the rest of their time with the federal public service. So that is a step in the right direction. The other thing is the best practice universal design, so designing research environments and workplaces so that people don't have to ask for accommodations. You're still always going to have somebody asking for something because you can't possibly foresee every single need, but having universal design and having your workplace policies and the physical design of your space and interaction for human be universal can minimize the need for individualized accommodations. And then the other one is, when people ask, just give it to them if you can, or work with them to figure out, you know, what that support is going to be or what the supports are going to look like. And as we said, one of the fundamental problems of us thinking about disability is we think about it as very stagnant. But in fact, a person's job changes, a person's needs change, their disability may change, all kinds of things. And so they may have, you know, what works for them at one point as an accessibility piece may not work for them somewhere else or at a different time. And so it is not a stagnant piece, it's dynamic, it needs to be reviewed. And a lot of the pain points of the accommodation process happen after the person has disclosed a need for accommodation when you start getting to try and legitimize the need for accommodation. People generally are not going to abuse that if they have a disability, especially in science where it is so highly stigmatized. They're probably not asking unless they really need something, so I would honor it and not ask them for a medical documentation up the wazoo to try and legitimize why they need that disability, because again, according to the law, they're not supposed to have to tell you about their need for a particular accommodation. So just, you know, work with them to figure out what the best accessibility supports will be without making them have a song and dance to prove to you that they need them.
So think about that for a moment. The current generation of scientists with disabilities, we all know how hard the system is. There is absolutely no psychological or material benefit to me lying to Angela about the fact that I need large print. None whatsoever. Because again, I know how difficult the system is. And so because I know that, my first choice isn't to tell Angela I need large print. My first choice is to actually not tell Angela I need large print, right? And so I'm gonna cave and tell Angela I need large print when I can't figure out a workaround for myself, right? So the interesting thing about the way that disability accommodations work is that the whole thing is a workplace risk assessment that dates back to manufacturing and people injuring themselves on the job and doesn't apply anymore in the knowledge economy in the context that we live in, particularly here at an institute like this one. If your default assumption is, well, Mahadio's lying, and Mahadio knows that your default assumption is that he's lying, he's not going to tell you anything in the first place, right? If I really were lying that badly and I didn't understand the system, oh boy, I'm going to figure it out real fast.
And the mental health impact of being accused of lying or even feeling like you're being accused of lying, it's huge. But there's nothing in the system that is there to support people with disabilities who constantly feel like this when they're going through an accommodation process or many processes as their job may change. The other piece of that is promotion. So there's a very big allergic reaction to promoting people who have accessibility supports. I don't know why this is in the workplace generally, not just in STEM, but persons with disabilities do not move on. There is a wage gap between persons with disabilities and those without. It's about 20% early in people's careers, but as people progress in their careers, it's as much as 45 to 50% of their earnings are lower, and it's because persons with disabilities are not promoted. They're not offered professional development. There's some sort of ingrained bias that says if you need accessibility support, then you know you must not be able to do a job that's different or requires different skills or something like that, and that is wrong.
We could add pigeonholing to weathering and cognitive load and imposter syndrome and trailblazing. Next.
Oh, I've got one final question, I think.
One more?
I might have to throw this one.
Ooh, yes!
Okay. Woo!
Nice catch.
So we do a lot of recruitment here at Parameter Institute. We recruit students, postdocs, faculty, also on the admin side, there's a lot of people we recruit. How do these kinds of considerations factor into recruitment? How do you see recruitment? Should we be changing our recruitment processes in view of this? This is before people get here, before we're making specific accommodations.
So the question is, I'm just going to repeat the question, and please tell me if I'm missing something. So because of the volume of recruitment that goes on here at PI, should we recommend that anything around recruitment pre-interview be changed in order to present a more welcoming environment to trainees and researchers and staff with disabilities or potential staff with disabilities?
And also post-interview, I mean, the whole process.
And so it's the whole process. So, you want me to start? Okay, so, I mean, first of all, the recruitment process needs to project an open and welcoming environment at the research institute. So let's go ahead and assume that we have an open and welcoming environment. So then the question is, how do we actually project that? Do we project that by saying, if you need help, ask for it? Or do we project that by saying, here are all the different supports that we put in place during the recruitment and interview process? So for everyone who comes to the Institute for an interview, this is what you will have in terms of accessibility support during the interview. If you need something else, please do ask for it. right? You could do that. You also are going to, you also could consider having conversations with your hiring committees and making sure that the hiring committees know that if somebody comes in and discloses on the spot, hey, guess what? I've got a lived experience with whatever, and by the way, that means that if during this interview you need to speak louder or repeat yourself, I might ask you to do that because I didn't hear the question. My team at CNIB collaborated with one of our collaborators in the Netherlands. We did a piece of work on what kinds of disclosure actually would work. The kind of disclosure that works best is the disclosure that actually goes something like this. If I ask you to repeat yourself during the interview, it's actually because I live with hearing loss and I may not have actually heard your question and I wasn't able to lip read it effectively. Are you able to just repeat it for me should that happen? As opposed to, I live with hearing loss and my cochlear implant is the best thing in the world. It helps me do my job and you don't need to worry about me, because that kind of ability first disclosure doesn't actually work. It doesn't engender what you want engendered from hiring committee. So if you present an open and welcoming environment and your hiring committees understand what to do if somebody were to actually disclose during the interview, right? I was in a faculty interview once where the conversation wasn't about me actually being a scientist. The conversation was about me getting to the city of Philadelphia. That was a manageable conversation, but it was, and I was young and not as experienced as I am now, and so I didn't deflect and push it back onto science. And so they never asked me the questions they needed to ask me to judge my candidacy, right? And that's the danger in an interview process, because if you are not capable of recognizing that you're steering the conversation in the wrong direction, it's probably because you're thrown in the interview by a disclosure, right? And you're sort of like, oh my goodness, I didn't expect that. Now I have all sorts of questions and I get to ask them. But you're not really supposed to ask them, right? What you're supposed to do is you're supposed to actually evaluate the candidate on their ability to proceed to do the job that is in front of them, not the job that you've made it out to be. So the canonical example of this is the one that I kind of illustrated, which is somebody presents with a lived experience with a disability. They live in a wheelchair. They use a wheelchair, or they use a white cane or a guide dog. And all of a sudden, the conversation is about how did they navigate to the workplace as opposed to how do they do the job, right? And you make it about the fact that the work involves travel. Well, you got to attend scientific conferences. How do you attend scientific conferences, right? But that's not the interview. So hiring committees need to know how to avoid those kinds of traps. Right? So your HR and recruitment processes have to project an open and welcoming space. You yourselves have to project an open and welcoming space. And when you do that, people will come to you and they will have a conversation with you because they're willing to have that conversation because they feel like you're receptive to it and you won't abuse it.
Thank you.
Ooh. Okay, thank you both for those answering those questions. I'm going to switch to the mic. But I just wanted to say thank you so much to both of you. I think throughout the sessions that you provided today, I think what I'm taking away in a large part is there's a lot of work to do and a lot of learning still for us to do. But what resonates with me is this piece about trust. Really, we're building this trust with people that are coming to our institute and including them in ways that they can participate in what we do. So they can learn, they can go forward, they can be a role model for others. I think that's really sticking with me. So I know that I have a lot to go away with and think on and think about how we can apply it better here and improve our processes. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
And there's coffee and treats in the bistro.